recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality. Hey everybody, thanks again for joining me. A few things I want to go over before we begin. First, thank you so much for the support. You are all amazing, and for the last 2 weeks, just with two episodes, with Spotify, Stitcher, Radio Public, and of course iTunes, we had over 600 listens. Holy crap. Thank you so much. The next thing I wanted to say is this episode is going to be a little different than the episodes coming in the future, or really how this podcast is supposed to be run, or what I thought it would be run as. I have, interviews are usually the focal point of the podcast, but when I recorded this interview, it was one of my first big interviews. Like, I didn't realize that I wanted it to be about 35-minute interviews and, you know, fully, entirely, so you hear my questions. So I do a lot of cutting in this episode, and at that point, I hadn't decided the format yet. So this interview is cut up. It was over 2 hours long, so I'll be telling you the story in between, and we'll try to do it like a TV news story. That's how I figured I would do this one. The last thing is I will be releasing the next episode next week. It's supposed to be every 2 weeks, this podcast, but I want you to hear what's coming up. I just spent the night at Fox Hollow Farm, which you will soon hear is in the episode, this episode, where Herb Baumeister killed many of his victims. It's part of a paranormal investigation event that I could buy tickets for, so I went, and obviously it was absolutely awesome. Honestly, I was a little scared going into it, but it turned out to be just fine. If you want to see part of that event, you can head to my Infamous Indie with Joe Melillo Facebook page, and also you can see it on my Instagram page. I went live a couple of times during the night, as well as recorded a podcast from the house that will be released next week. I just wanted to tell you that this is coming out, so be ready and be excited, because it's definitely very interesting. I do not plan to do podcasts or paranormal podcasts on a regular basis. I just thought this is a perfect segue and a perfect combination, so why not just do it? All right, and with those announcements, let's get right into it. Here is the true crime history of Herb Baumeister.
Right now, no, they could be anything from animals carrying parts of the skeleton away and dropping them off here or there. Could be it's on a hill, so possibly even rain won't run off as much water as we've had lately.
On June 24th, 1996, investigators from the Hamilton County Sheriff's Department were searching the backyard of a home of a well-respected businessman, husband, and father of three, Herb Baumeister. The home was a mansion. It's called Fox Hollow Farm, and it sat on a huge piece of land with horse stables, a creek that ran through the backyard, and an indoor pool. The Baumeisters had been living there only a few years at that point, but things were still in boxes, and some rooms were a total disaster. Outside in the backyard, by the tree line, investigators were sifting through tens of thousands of bone fragments, some as small as pebbles, some were the size of femur bones. It was a hot summer, the trees were full, and the work was daunting. Police were finding bones in the creek that ran behind the Baumeister home. This is what they told Wish TV, a local news station, in an interview.
People just have missing people, and they've heard that we have found human remains on the property here, and they're just inquiring as to what we have and letting us know who is missing out of their families or what it might be, what their questions are.
Months later, eventually confirmed there were 11 bodies in that backyard. Some of the bones were in burn pits, others were just lying in the yard, mostly decayed, not buried or covered in any way. Police were able to identify the 11 victims because of 11 different thumb bones they were able to find. There could have been more, but that's never been confirmed. Many of those bodies were identified as the missing gay men from Indianapolis. Now, before 1996, in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a problem sweeping through the Circle City. In the underground gay nightclub scene, men were going missing on a regular occasion. Many would frequent the Indianapolis downtown gay bars and then never be seen again. But some did show up again, in Ohio, on the side of the road, dead, strangled, and in a ditch. Ohio investigators didn't know why so many men from Indianapolis were being found in Ohio off I-70. That highway, by the way, runs directly through both Indiana and Ohio, east to west. My interview for this episode is a man by the name of Virgil Vandegrift. He was employed by the families of two missing gay men to look into their disappearances. He worked as a Marion County Sheriff Detective, and he did later open his own private investigation firm in Indianapolis. That firm specialized in missing person cases. It's still, to this day, a working private investigation firm. He had extensive training in serial killer tracking and worked hand-in-hand with law enforcement even after going out on his own. He also had a few members of his staff he would pay. One of them was a retired detective. Another was just a civilian to help him do these investigations. He sat down with me in his office to talk about the case. Like I said before, we talked for 2 hours.
It started out with two different families that hired me to find missing relatives. And when I looked at both of them matched the same physical description, both gay.
160 pounds, 5'9", brown hair.
Yeah.
Skinny.
Alcoholics. I made up missing persons posters for the guys. And so I sent investigators out to all the gay bars to get information and to put out the flyers, etc. One of the investigators came back later and he said, "I ain't going back." Anyway, so that generated information. We also had another witness that saw one of the missing people getting into a vehicle and gave a description of the vehicle and said it had Ohio plates on it. With the Ohio plate in the name, we, at that time, assumed that the person was probably from Ohio. So I did a ton of research in Ohio trying to come up with that person. And I came up with some people with similar names, but not him. Anyway, in doing that, I also contacted the police agencies in that area. So I contacted the state police over in Ohio and talked to them. And one of the investigators I talked to over there and I asked him if they had any bodies show up around water or in water or whatever. And he said, "Are you kidding me?" He said, "We got them all the time." And he said, I can't remember any that matched the profile, but he said, "Yeah, I'll check further." Well, then another investigator from Dayton, Ohio, called me that worked for the district attorney's office, and he said, "Oh yeah, I got some that matched exactly." So, so me and him kind of got a bond together and was working together.
With Ohio police working with Vandegrift, he called IMPD to get some more help. Mary Wilson, at that time, was the lead of the missing persons IMPD unit.
Back then, in Indianapolis, if you reported somebody missing, there had to be a waiting period before they would assign an investigator, a missing person. And during that early time period, the police was not doing anything, really. And then Mary Wilson from Missing Persons Bureau got involved. and she was very good. We worked well together. Yeah, we worked well together. We shared information continuously. There were some things that we could do. People were more most likely going to talk to us before they talked to the police. But and on top of that, the police had access to data that we didn't have access to. So,
do you think that relationship helped?
Oh yeah,
in the end,
definitely.
But the leads were going nowhere, and the case was drying up quickly. Except when Virgil got a call from a man with an incredible story, the informant. We will call and will be referring to him for anonymity's sake as Tony Harris. Tony tells Virgil one night at a gay bar in downtown Indy, he met a man calling himself Brian Smart. Brian Smart was later confirmed to be the fake name Herb Baumeister was using when he went out on town. Tony says he recognized him as a regular and even remembers seeing a friend of his get into a car with Brian Smart one night. That friend was then missing. He had never seen him again. Tony tells Virgil he decided to take matters into his own hands. He went home with Baumeister that night. This is where Tony's account of what happened gives us a little insight into what maybe Herb's victims went through. Once Tony and Baumeister were in the car together, Baumeister drove all the way out the city, taking weird back roads the whole time. At this point, Baumeister offered him drugs, which Tony refused. Now, Westfield is about 30 minutes north of Indianapolis, so Herb was clearly trying to confuse them. They get to the property, which is a huge piece of land with a long winding driveway. The only thing Harris says he can remember about what the sign out front said was either Fox or Farms. Baumeister tells Tony he was only watching the home for the owner who was out of town. When they get inside, Tony is brought downstairs to the indoor pool where they continue their nightcap. And surrounding the pool, Harris sees mannequins. They're all dressed up and positioned as if they were having a party. When asked about it, Herb tells Harris he gets lonely sometimes. Baumeister offers him drugs again and another drink. Again, Harris refused. Harris also recalls Baumeister heading to the bathroom at one point, assuming he did some drugs himself. While hanging out and getting more comfortable with each other, Baumeister eventually brings up the topic of erotic asphyxiation, saying it's fun and it's a way to heighten the experience of sex. Baumeister then explained to Tony how to do it. Just choke the person, cutting off the air to the brain just enough where they feel like they will pass out and then let go. And while having sex, you will have a euphoric experience. Tony Harris may be a little drunk, he may have been a little confused, but he agreed. Baumeister took the pool hose, he wrapped it around Harris's throat, and he started to choke him with it. When it came to the moment where Baumeister should have let go, Harris realized he wasn't going to. He pretended to pass out so that Baumeister would just let go. When Harris sat up, Baumeister looked surprised, and at that point, Harris knew exactly who Baumeister really was. He was the man responsible for his missing friend. To this day, police have never been able to prove that this is exactly what happened to the other men who were murdered, but you can imagine the next steps after he did kill them or strangle them. Baumeister would bring the bodies to the backyard, either burn them, and then later killings, have them in the yard to rot. Harris and Baumeister did spend the night together. They stayed in bed, and Harris even had a chance to get up once Baumeister passed out to look around. The next morning, Baumeister drove Harris back to his car at the bar and then said goodbye. Tony Harris called Vandegrift, which turned out to be the big break that everyone was looking for, and Vandegrift had the lead.
The informant gave us a pretty good description of the general area. So I'm thinking, you know, how are we going to zero in on the property? Well, I did two things. First thing I did, I had an investigator working for me that was retired from the state police. So I sent him up to talk to all the police departments up there in the area to see if there was, if they could remember any, because at the time the only thing we had was some property that had a sign that said Fox something the other.
Or farms.
Well, not even farms.
Not even farms, just Fox something.
Yeah. So anyway, he's up there talking to the police, trying to get information to them if they remembered, you know, something like that, which was getting zero. So I got thinking about it. So I sent a civilian employee up to the assessor's office in Hamilton County and got all the aerial photos of all the property in that area. So after I got the aerial photos, back then they would have a plane or whatever fly over and take pictures of whatever for tax purposes. So I had an informant come in and I showed him the aerial photos, and he looked at the one that I felt was the best property, and he said, well, I'm not sure. I've never seen it from that angle. So anyway, I felt pretty certain that was the correct property. So I had him go with my retired trooper up to the property, and they drove it, and he called me back and said, yep, this is it. So we knew then where it was. And of course, from the tax records, then we could get a name.
But police couldn't do anything, even with all the info from Tony Harris.
Yeah, they weren't buying into that a serial killer would be up there, and then they didn't want to believe the informant, etc. Now, having said that, at that particular point in time, the informant was a full-blown alcoholic too, etc. And so I could understand why they would have some difficulties. However, they didn't do anything. What I mean by that is they took the information. They did have the FBI come in and work with them on it a little bit. The only, and of course they tried to escape it by saying, well, you can't prove that there was a crime ever committed in Hamilton County. And we said, no, because we can't get on the property. IPD went so far as to fly over the property with heat sensing equipment, trying to find something in that way too.
Again, police investigation was at a standstill. The only way they could get onto Fox Hollow Farm property is if they had enough evidence for a warrant, which they didn't, or if the other owner, Julie Baumeister, let them on. Police did try a few times, telling her that Herb was involved in something called homosexual homicide, but she refused to believe her husband had anything to do with that. They couldn't get that one piece of evidence needed to prove there was a crime committed on the property. They did come close once. It was reported at the time that Tony Harris escaped from Fox Hollow Farm that Baumeister showed up to his home looking for Tony, possibly to finish the job he started. Tony did call for police. Investigators used Harris to set up a meeting between Baumeister and himself, but Baumeister never showed. And this is where things really get interesting for you, for me, for this podcast. I'm about to tell you something completely different than what's ever been reported, and it could change the outlook of this case forever. During my interview with Virgil, he tells me what was really going on between Tony Harris and Herb Baumeister.
Well, there were things that has never been revealed. He had several encounters with Herb, actually went to the house several times, and actually Herb actually went to his house too.
To look for him?
Well, not to really look for him. They were socializing. Mm.
Do you think that the informant did that to keep him...
Yeah,
make sure that he didn't turn the other way and turn murderous towards him. You're appeasing Herb in the meantime while you're hoping the investigation is going on. I could see that turmoil going on in his brain.
Yeah,
that informant.
Yeah, he was doing that, I think he became somewhat infatuated with Herb also, in the way that he was thinking, you know, etc. I mean, he challenged him many times, meaning challenging to the point of saying, kill me or go ahead and do it or whatever. And Herb would say, no, I like you, I'm not going to kill you, you know. Now, having said that, the informant won't agree with me on this point, but he did not match the physical description of what Herb normally would pick on. And I think that had a bearing. Yeah.
Above 6 foot and Herb like?
Weighs 6'5", I think.
Yeah, he's tall. Big guy.
Yeah.
Did Herb know that the informant was doing as much as he could to bring him down? Or was it kind of a secret thing?
Yeah, he told Herb that he was talking to the police.
About him?
Yeah.
And Herb didn't care?
No, he thought he was so smart that, you know, he could outsmart everybody anyway.
So who was this guy who thought he was smarter than everyone? Who was this guy, Herb Baumeister? Let's go back a little bit. Growing up, Baumeister was born and raised in a relatively wealthy part of Indianapolis, the Butler-Tarkington neighborhood. Butler, the college, is near there. His father was a doctor and his mother was, well, over the top. One story that has come out was when he was a boy, he would urinate on his teacher's desk. He also once picked up a dead crow off the road and used it for a prank.
When you look at the profile of a serial killer, Herb back when he's growing up younger, some, not all, some serial killers do things with animals, kill them, whatever they do with them. And so Herb had that when he was growing up, that he would kill animals or whatever.
Torture them.
So that kind of fits in with the serial killer part of it. You know, they have this fascination with dead animals and or killing them themselves.
Plus the power over something smaller than you seems to be a running theme.
Yeah, when you really study it, it goes back to the parents. The parents usually are overbearing, over-dominating parents.
Yeah.
And so part of it has to do with that. And his mother was a very controlling person. Fact matter is, she, even up until close to the day he died, she was still financing a lot of his business stuff, etc. Part of his makeup indicated that you know, that's what he was, I hate to say, destined to be.
Yeah.
but you know,
he graduated from high school. He attended Indiana University, where he met his future wife, Julie Sater. On their first date, he used a Hearst to pick her up. Herb and Julie eventually did get married. They had 3 children. He had a job at the local DMV. While he worked there, he was mean, and some of the stories include Herb urinating on a letter, and he also urinated on a boss's desk on 2 separate occasions. He would also keep feces in the bottom drawer of his desk just to watch it decay. Some of his coworkers did talk to the local news when everything came out.
Herbert Baumeister's friends describe him as a man who had nervous tendencies, a fairly explosive temper, and a strange sense of humor.
He was just a major prankster, and with that in mind, he just, anything for a laugh, he would do, but on the other side, he was still pretty compassionate, too. He didn't want to take him to too far extremes to hurt anybody.
Randy Hartley worked with Baumeister for several years at the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. So did Alan Fishburne.
I was shocked. I was mortally shocked because in knowing her for the past 15, 16 years, I found him, you know, as a spontaneous, do any type of thing person within, you know, certain reasons.
The Baumeisters lived a modest life in the near north side of Indianapolis until Herb opened the thrift store called Save-A-Lot. He would hire young boys, which, now looking back on, is very curious. And this is what some of his employees said about him.
He was jumpy. He was a nervous man. He was a very nervous man.
The store did so well the first year that he opened a second and then eventually a third. The family moved to a mansion in Fox Hollow Farm in Westfield soon after. Julie and the kids on a regular basis went up to Baumeister's mother's lake house in Lake Wawasee, Indiana. It wasn't unusual for the family to be separate since Julie and Herb had a weird relationship. Julie later said they only had sex 6 times their entire 25-year marriage. One of the first signs Herb was starting to mess up was Herb's son Eric found a skull in the backyard. When Julie brought it up, Herb dismissed it as a cadaver used by his father that he found in the garage, and he just threw it in the yard. Julie never asked about it again. Fast forward, again, to here we go, 1995 to 1996. Virgil's investigation was stalling, despite the info from that informant, and police were trying to prove that Baumeister was a suspect.
My clients were not rich, so at some point in time, I had to make a decision, because I was paying my employees, of when do I cut, period, because I can't continue to afford to fund everything. At some point in time, after we found the property up there, etc., I pretty much stopped sending people out to do stuff because they had to pay their salaries. Relied totally upon Indianapolis police to get the job done. Having said that, we started getting a lot of cooperation from the gay community, etc., and they were putting pressure on people too to get things done. Anyway, I continued to feed information into IPD that I would come up with by communicating with people. And at the time, I had an office, female office manager that was fantastic. She had a good rapport with a lot of the people in the gay community and was getting a lot of information from them.
If you remember, police did try to get Julie to let him on the property, but then she refused until her lawyer suggested otherwise. And this is on June 24th, 1996. She let them on the property. Just in the first few steps, investigators saw bones everywhere, even a bone connected to handcuffs.
The pathologist, or the guy from university, they have 5,000 bone fragments that they can't identify. I mean, that's a lot of bone fragments.
You think so, huh?
Wow.
Because there's not enough of them to get DNA off of, and even if they get DNA off of them, they don't have any money to do it.
Yeah. Again, no skulls were ever found. I asked Virgil what he thinks happened to those skulls.
With them having 5,000 bone fragments, my gut feeling says he just crushed the skulls. But
he wouldn't have kept them somewhere?
Oh, I suppose it's possible. You know, many serial killers like trophies.
That's what I'm thinking.
You know, that property up there has been searched pretty thoroughly. Mm. If there's any around, I don't think they're up there on that property.
At the time, Wish TV and other news outlets were on the scene as bones were being unearthed.
On the day that, I think it was Channel 8 or one of the channels, whatever channel it was, actually came on the news and showed people up on the farm searching the area. Herb Baumeister was at my informant's house watching it on TV.
Wish TV.
Yeah, okay.
Wish TV, great. Do you know what time that was?
Nah, time of day. And during daytime, I don't know what.
Not the morning show. Early morning.
Don't know.
Here's why. There's a story in the station. My photographer I work with on a daily basis to this day, he's a 30-year veteran at Wish. His name's Marcus. Marcus and I have gone over the story a couple times. He was up at Fox Hollow. Nobody knew what was going on. The FBI wasn't saying anything. Police weren't saying anything. All they knew is that they were searching the property and found human remains. That's mm-hmm. all they knew. And the reporter, as a joke, wrote a fake story about this Westfield businessman is secretly a gay serial killer. Apparently, that story ran the next morning by accident on TV. That morning, the news director called, because the FBI called the station and said, "Where did you get this information?" And then they were like, "It was a joke. It wasn't supposed to run. It was fake." And it was true.
Yeah.
So he made it up and he got it right. So just guess. He hit it. So there's this thought that Herb saw that and went up to Lake Wawasee with his son.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes! Thanks for telling me. Kidding me.
No.
So he saw it and got nervous and ran.
Yeah. Yeah, he was at the informant's house with a gun, and the informant was... He was accusing the informant of, you know, causing the broadcast, whatever, and he was armed with a gun.
Did Herb know that the informant was doing as much as he could to bring him down, or was it kind of a secret thing?
Yeah, he told Herb that he was talking to the police.
About him?
Yeah.
And Herb didn't care.
No, he thought he was so smart that, you know, he could outsmart everybody anyway.
So while police were on the property looking through the bones, Julie was afraid something would happen to her son, Eric, because Eric had gone up with his father to Lake Wawasee. Herb took him with him. She asked the Hamilton County Sheriff's Department to go get Eric from Herb. When deputies arrived, Baumeister turned over Eric, no problem. But they didn't arrest Baumeister. At that point, they didn't have enough evidence to. Now here's what always has been reported. Herb then went north to Canada. He was then seen sleeping on the side of the road at some point. A Canadian Mountie walked up to him, knocked on the window to wake him up, and when she looked in the back, she saw videotapes in the back. She didn't know who he was or what he was doing there, so she let him go. A few days later, he was found with a gunshot wound to the head. Apparently, he committed suicide. But Virgil says that's not true.
Because there was no gun found up in Canada, as I've been told at this point, I just don't buy the theory that somebody came along and saw a gun and picked it up, saw a body and a gun, picked it up and left with the gun. I just don't buy that. Now, is it possible? I suppose it's possible, but have you talked to the guy that found the body in Canada?
No.
Him and his family were up there hiking, whatever, and came across the body and you know, saw that it was kind of ritualistic. He inferred also that there was another area fairly close to there that looked like maybe there might have been something going on, you know, prior to... he says that he looked all over the place and couldn't find any gun. Yeah, he did find the suicide note, yeah. But so-called suicide note, but in reality, to me, it's not a suicide note. It's a sorry, I fucked things up, and that whole Canada thing is screwed up too. Well, number one, he supposedly laid himself out in a ritual type thing. and had some dead birds on each side of him. But there was no gun found. Now, Canada, their theory is that somebody came along and saw him and saw the gun and stole the gun. That's their theory of what happened to the gun.
He was like on an altar of sand, almost.
Yeah.
And with the birds laid out, yeah. Dead birds with broken necks, right? Very similar to what he would do.
Do as a kid, yeah.
Yeah. Leaves more questions than answers there.
Well, I don't think he shot himself.
Herb Baumeister didn't commit suicide, according to Virgil. He was killed by someone else. But that story is for another day. Believe me, it's very complicated. I will try to bring it to you. Police did find a note at the scene, and it wasn't as revealing as some would be hoping. He regretted messing up the part. He felt badly about his broken marriage and failing business. He did not mention the remains of his victims or admit to any crime. He described the items on his trip, including his intention to kill himself at a different place, but he saw some children there, so he changed his mind. His final meal was a peanut butter sandwich. With Julie Baumeister's help, investigators from Ohio Murders pieced together the evidence that linked Baumeister to the I-70 murders. Receipts provided by Julie showed that Baumeister had traveled along I-70 during the times the bodies were found dumped along the interstate. A sketch drawn from a description by an eyewitness who thought he saw the I-70 murder looked just like Baumeister. Bodies stopped showing up along the interstate at the same time that Baumeister moved to Fox Hollow Farm, where he had plenty of land to hide the bodies. By the time it was all over, Herb was only suspected of being a serial killer. He never was officially charged. He killed himself before he could get arrested. He killed 16 people, suspected killing 16 people. But there could be more. Julie and the kids have since changed their names and moved on. The only thing that's left is this house, which stands to this day. The new owners there say there have been a lot of paranormal encounters over the number of years that they've lived there, and they believe the house is haunted. As for Virgil Vandegrift, this isn't the only case he covered. In fact, he has a lot of experience with serious crime here in Indiana, and I will be bringing another interview or two with you to you about him. His experience is deep, and he's seen a lot of evil. But despite that, he says there is something good that did come out of this case. And as always on this podcast, we try to find the positives of true crime. Something good came out of this horrible circumstance.
Well, one of the positives that happened in as a relationship to this is that they changed the laws to where on a missing person, they can't have that waiting time period. That was one of the positives that came out of this case. I would like to see more resources placed into missing people, regardless of who they are. You know, that in today's world, it's gotten so bizarre with, you know, the people that are selling young females for prostitution purposes and all that stuff.
Before I let you go, I do want to remind you to check out my social media pages for my time at Fox Hollow Farm. Stay tuned for the full episode that is coming next week, and I also want to acknowledge that Wish TV did provide some of the archive footage for the coverage of this investigation. If you'd like to see that, head over to the Infamous Indie YouTube channel. Thank you for joining me today. Show notes and links will be on the website, infamousindie.com. Please like, subscribe, comment, and share. Thank you again, and as always, stay safe.